Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Maddock. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Maddock. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by my buddy, Pat Mayo, CoronaCast number 9, back on the TakeCast feed. This can also be found on the PME feed as well. Assume a lot of you guys have found this show from listening to Pat. This is likely our last conversation for a few weeks as Pat is about to go be a father for the second time. His wife is about to have their second child. So, you know, this is just kind of us wrapping up from when we started recording these 2 months ago for to when we started recording now. What's it been like? What has living through the coronavirus been like? What has it been like in the States? What has it been like in Canada? How are we feeling about it? Everything going on. So hope you guys enjoy it. Hope you guys like it. And if you want to support the show, you can subscribe to patreon.com/takecast for bonus episodes of the show, or just leave a rating, a review on iTunes. That's very useful and helpful to the show as well. I'd really appreciate it. So thank you very much, and let's go ahead and get into the episode.
Has anything changed with you over the past like week in terms of everything? Because I, for one, have started to wash my hands a lot more again.
Yeah, I mean, I think just like, brain-wise, I think I'm just preparing myself for people I know to just be like, all right, it's time to get back to it, you know, just like time to go back to living.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the reasons I started washing my hands more, just being more cognizant, because I think we had spoke before about how that had kind of fallen by the wayside. Like, I know coming, like,
yeah, because I didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, and coming, even like when I was coming in and out of my office, there was only two of us in the like entire building that were using the bathrooms or walking in and out of the building, everything like that. But now that people are kind of back to work, there's more people around, that it seems like a smarter thing to do now than it did 2 weeks ago, weirdly enough.
Yeah. And also, you know, like I'm just going to wear a mask going places. Cause like, if I can't think like if I don't trust the average person to be being responsible about what they're exposing themselves to, you know, how they're handling germs and stuff, like I'm gonna wear a mask.
But the mask is not going to protect you from it. Doesn't that protect the other people from it?
Yeah, it's so like the way that I understand the research is that it's mostly like if you're a carrier, it helps it from spreading, and it just overall, it would be very helpful if everyone wore a mask, because it's just harder for the virus to spread that way. It's not, you know, it doesn't solve the whole problem. We don't solve the pandemic overnight. It just really limits the spread if everyone were to wear masks indoors.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad we were able to kind of put a cap on this series. I mean, ideally, by the time I'm back to doing shows full time again, that we won't need to do a CoronaCast anymore. That would be great, wouldn't it?
Oh, buddy. I think the direction that we see this going in now is people are able to make their own decisions about the risk, and a lot of really vulnerable populations, you know, people without healthcare, people who've lost their jobs during this, elderly people, a lot of them are really going to bear the brunt of that decision by these people, and there are going to be some unnecessary deaths. But I also think that, you know, this certainly was a situation. I mean, I got to hand it to the people who, I don't have to, I am choosing to hand it to the people who disagree with me politically on a lot of things, that it is true that some of the models that politicians were using to base their decisions on these things were not right. And it's also true that the economic and, you know, even like emotional ramifications of extended shelter in place orders were huge, right? There have been massive economic ramifications, and like, just I'm sure you know, suicide rates are up. Like I'm sure there are more people who are depressed than ever just from, you know, being literally stuck in their houses all day.
Yeah, I'm not someone who's like prone to depression, but I can't imagine how it would be if you were, only because like I feel like low all the time, like just being stuck in. I'm sure that most people feel that way, not going anywhere, falling into the same like lazy routine every day, that if you were prone to mental illness in any sort of way, that this would only exacerbate the situation.
Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, being a highly anxious person. I mean, what about people who actually have like, you know, not depression or anxiety, but like you know, people who are bipolar, schizophrenic, you know, and maybe they were borderline of those things, you know, borderline schizophrenic, like, you know, where you're not full on, you're not in a home, like you can kind of live your life. I would imagine that that makes that so much worse.
Yeah, as not a doctor, I don't know, but that would be my...
Yeah, I don't know either.
That would be my inclination as well, that this is just bad across the board for everyone. But, you know, hopefully that people take enough precautions that this is it. Like, we've been through the worst of it, but I don't know. Like, on a range of outcomes, how likely do you think that is?
If we are going back in, like, if we're just opening it back up and a lot of people aren't going to take precautions, I would imagine we have not been through the worst of it, at least in terms of like death wise. Now, maybe we've been through the worst of it for many, many people because, you know, economic things are going to start to go back to normal, jobs, schools, or whatever, going to start to go back to normal, maybe. But I would imagine that if we just go back to living life, that the health can, like, you know, public health stuff is still going to be quite bad.
Well, how do you, like, what is everything going on right now with like where you're at in Kansas City? Like, is it a complete reopen?
No. So the governor here in Missouri still had, I don't think the shelter in place orders are still in place, but you know, everywhere you go, people are wearing masks. Social distancing is like mandated by the governor. There are still, like, you know, some public parks and stuff are like they have police, like they have park rangers, like going around and making sure, you know, that stuff is still not being, like, you know, not too far back to normal, I guess. So I think where I am at, we've sort of found the beginning of a happy medium.
Yeah, like we're doing in Toronto partial, like there's a three-step reopening that the premier has put in place. So I think that I'm not sure if it happened on Thursday or it's happening on Tuesday because it's a long weekend in Canada. It's Victoria Day. So this is like the first big weekend where people generally go out, go camping, go to their cottages, whatever it might be. So I'm curious to see how that sticks in. But if it did happen on Thursday, like I've been in and out of the office, so I've seen people around. I've been to the store, that people are following like the guidelines that were in place pretty well. Like,
yeah.
If people will continue to do this, I'm optimistic at least.
Yeah, I am, I think, optimistic if people continue to behave the way they are behaving right now. I am, I think, pessimistic that, you know, once a couple people go out and they're like, they're living their lives and they go to the store and maybe they, you know, they go to a restaurant for the first time and grab dinner 6 feet socially distance and it's fine. Like, I'm worried that the more individual people who find themselves not getting sick or don't know someone who's getting sick, the further and further the behavior stretches from being cautious, and the further away we get from cautious behavior, the closer we are to like a big second outbreak.
Yeah. So you think that people will become almost like it did during like a quarantine with people staying at home, that like, oh yeah, I don't need to wash my hands as much, but I mean, that would make sense because I'm not going out anywhere all the time, that there's going to be a malaise that sets in over the course of like a month kind of thing. And by the way, I called it almost to the day, and we've been doing this from episode one. May 13th was my day that people would have had enough, and that's about when it happened.
Yeah, I mean, you did. You definitely did call it. Yeah, I mean, that would be my exact worry, right? The general malaise would be my exact worry, that just people start to be a little bit too lax. And, you know, like, there's this big worry that and this has been put out from several epidemiologists and stuff, that America is just, the United States of America is not a culture that will be receptive to doing a lot of the things that will prevent a virus from spreading. And I would say that I probably agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, I think that the reason that it's been worse in America, like the numbers dictate that it has been worse in America, like, but trying to wrap my mind around it, like when you're dealing with that many people, obviously you can't believe a word China says. Like China's per capita numbers per million people is zero. Like that might be true because there's like 2 billion people, but that also seems not right at the same time. That I like, where would you gauge compared to the rest of the world, how would you gauge how the United States is actually done with this?
I think it's pretty clear that our leadership has not been as strong at handling this stuff as others. You know, like we've had governors who have just been completely clueless, you know, being like, oh, I didn't know the virus spreads that way. And, you know, I think there's been a real lack of direction at a federal level. Like, it seems like the government decides on a new path for combating the coronavirus every day. And there's very little unification between state and federal governments, different branches of the federal government. Like, it seems like a mess. And the mostly why it seems like a mess to me is that Americans have, I think, undergone a huge sacrifice, and many people in many countries have undergone a huge sacrifice. You know, many people have lost their jobs. People have not seen their friends, not seen their loved ones. There's been funerals with no one in attendance. People have skipped their weddings, you know, done Zoom weddings. And it feels like almost like that effort by the American people has been wasted because there's no plan. There doesn't seem to be a plan in place for how to proceed. And that is, that's a bummer.
Well, it does kind of seem like the plan never really changed, was that this isn't as serious as you think it is, and that's just going to be our game plan. And they were kind of right.
No, I mean, hey, look, those people, the people who said this virus is not as deadly as we thought at first, those people were right, right? My original thoughts of what the death rate and stuff like that would be, they were wrong. I was wrong about how fatal this disease would be to the average person. The issue you're going to have now, the issue that we have now, is that it's very hard to reopen things, get things going when we don't have a great amount of testing. And it's still just terrifying to think that, like, on average, like 2,000 people a day are dying of this in the United States. Like, it's very hard to be like, all right, like, let's get concerts and sports, like, and all these people are still dying. So even though the fatality rate is much lower than originally projected, it's not low enough to just, you know, open it back up.
No, see, that would be my biggest concern. Like, I'm good with not going to sporting events or concerts or gigantic congregations, anything like that. But it does feel like people want that back right away. And someone has to play the bad guy to be like, you can't do this. I'm sorry. Like, it's just not happening.
Yeah, I mean, people want their concerts. They want to go to church. They want to do all the things that they love to do. They want to jam into bars and all that stuff. And I don't know, man, whatever. Call me a Trump derangement syndrome beta cuck all you want. I can't see it being a good idea.
No, it doesn't appear to be a good idea. And I'm glad to be wrong on that. Like, that's not stuff you have to do. Like, it's fun.
Imagine,
it's fun to go do. But
being wrong about this. That means everyone wins.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's, I'm good personally, and I know that not everyone is the same way, of sacrificing those things so we can, like, incrementally get back to the point where we're good.
Yeah, many people don't want to sacrifice those things, but, like, I'm fine with my, you know, getting out of the house activity being golfing outside or, you know, hanging out in my front yard 5 feet away from some friends, right? Like, I'm cool. I'm cool with that being socialized, like my activities for now. There are many people, you know, there are many people who just, they have very rarely been told no in their lives. And they think that being asked to wear a mask or being asked to sacrifice and do something for the greater good is being oppressed. And there's really no reasoning with those people, I guess.
I suppose so, but I think that these people are more prevalent online than you actually encounter.
That's true.
That you actually encounter in real life, because you just kind of said that, like, when you go to places, you see people wearing masks. When I go to places, I see people wearing masks. It's not 100% of people, but when it comes to, like, outside of the door right now, my studio is below a drugstore, but it's like a doubles as a supermarket as well. Like, you can buy food there, mm-hmm. You can buy whatever. And there's a lineup out the door because there's only so many people that can go into the store at one time. And every single person in that line is like 8 feet apart.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually, I was driving somewhere yesterday and I drove by a Trader Joe's and I saw that everyone in the line was socially distanced. And I was like, you know, honestly, I really, you know, given the political dynamics at play in Missouri, I really would not have expected that. And I am, that is encouraging stuff for me.
Yeah, because I think that people, whether they're let's reopen it right away, you know, this isn't as bad kind of thing. I feel everyone worries about this. Like, no one is denying this is a real thing. And that was always like kind of the fear at the beginning is like, well, people just don't believe this is a real thing. Everyone believes it's a thing.
Maybe not everyone, but like 90% of people.
Yeah, not, I would say like 99% of people. You're going to get insane people, sure, but the close to 100% of people understand that there are risks with this. And I was actually listening to like a viral control type person, and they were talking about like why the correlation to the flu is completely different. And I thought this was really interesting, and maybe this has been talked about a bunch, but I hadn't heard it. Like, influenza in general attacks kids, whereas this generally attacks people with bad immune systems, the elderly. Like, people with diabetes are going down at, like, a really, like, that would be terrifying. Apparently, if you have diabetes, like, do not get coronavirus. That's not going to work out well. But that's just a weird shift in, like, who a virus attacks, and the coronavirus itself is just more aggressive once you have it, if you're susceptible to it.
Yeah, because as we've talked about, there's no herd immunity to this at all. Like, your body just doesn't have any built-in antibodies whatsoever at all to deal with this. But yeah, it is interesting that the flu travels via kids. Kids get it, and it seems like, you know, not kids are immune, because there have been some kids that have died of the coronavirus, but that it's the way that this virus works. It is much harder for it to impact the immune system of children. Whereas this is just like, if you're fat, if you are like, I mean, I think cancer patients obviously run really bad with this stuff. Just like any pre-existing health conditions are a total nightmare with this.
Yeah. Obesity is a really big one that's been pointed out. Do you think that's a reason that America has been struggling with this?
You said it, not me, man.
I mean, I don't live in America, but I've been to America a lot. But I mean, that would, you can say that in one sense, but like, I would say that the fittest place I've ever lived is probably Toronto. People are, you know, there's fat people everywhere, obviously. But like in the downtown core of Toronto, people are generally pretty fit. And I noticed the same thing when I lived in Manhattan too. So what's that really telling me? It's not like people in Manhattan were fine.
Right. I saw this interesting theory the other day that like loud talking, like people yelling, like or like sports arenas, like that is basically like projectile vomiting. Like if you have the virus and that happens, like there's this sort of theory that obviously there's just the transmission rates are going to be so much higher in cities, but like, you know, in Italy, they basically traced back the outbreak of the disease to like this really highly attended soccer game. And there's some theory that, like, you know, places where people are yelling and making a lot of noise are very likely to be like super high transmission centers. And, you know, that's a bummer.
That's a logical way of thinking, though, because if you're speaking very lowly, there's not a lot of projectile coming out of your mouth, like spit or anything like that, where if you're yelling, there probably is.
Yeah, it's going everywhere.
And if all people are yelling at the same time, like at a sporting event, everyone's mouths are open, too.
Yeah, so that just, and people are high-fiving and shaking hands and everything. Like, I don't know, man. I got to think that it's going to be years before I go to a sporting event or concert or something, which is a huge bummer because I love going to sporting events. I love going to concerts, and that's going to be a bummer. And I imagine that there are going to be many other people who go back to those things and are far more comfortable, you know, than I am. And that's, you know, it's going to give me some envy, I guess.
Well, yeah, I would probably be more on, probably not as pessimistic as you are in attending one of these things, but I think that I would lean more on that side of caution, if this is still kicking around, probably not going to go to a Raptors game. I'll just watch it on TV. I'll be okay with that. But people will go back. Like, I worry about, and actually I talked about this briefly on a show that's upcoming, because this, like I said, this is the last thing I'm going to record before I go on paternity leave. So I got a lot. I got 16 shows in the bank, Davis.
How blessed.
I mean, it took a lot of hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I meant how blessed of me to be the last one to talk to you before you go have your child.
Yeah, and we recorded back-to-back shows. We get like 3 hours chatting together. Unfortunately, this one's not all about fantasy football, like the one that people will hear in like 4 days' time, but here we are. But I was talking to Cuss and Jeff about it a little bit. Like, the SEC is like planning on running everything out with fans right away, it sounds like, and that just sounds like a terrible idea. Putting like 100,000 people in Louisiana where there's already an outbreak? Like, come on.
it seems like the Deep South is... They just want to get back to it. Like it's an area where people, again, it seemed like the spread was wider, but that, you know, no one was really all that worried about it. And, you know, maybe the fact that there just are not deaths left, right, and center in Florida, maybe that should be a huge signal to all of us that, you know, maybe we should all chill out a little bit, you know?
Yeah. And maybe people were more right about the hot weather than maybe we had given them credit for. Maybe just being outside.
Could be.
And maybe the theory that if you're outside, it's just harder to get.
I think I just believe that, right? Like, I just think that the transmission stuff outside is really low, right? Like, I just, or maybe I just have to believe that because, like,
you go
I'm
outside.
Going in, I, yeah, I'm going insane inside my house and I have been doing activities outside, but also, yeah, personal experience. I've been doing things outside. Like I've been golfing. I've gone a couple, you know, I've done a couple things outside and, I'm not dead. I don't have the coronavirus to my knowledge. So maybe that's just some bias sneaking in there.
What's the mood like at the golf courses?
Well, I go golf with old farts. I golf with my girlfriend's uncle here and his buddies. And let me tell you, no people at the golf. Many people at the golf course are they would be considered coronavirus truthers. I guess.
Like they don't believe it's real, or they just don't care.
Yeah, like I mean, you know, they're not. They're not taking social distancing 100% seriously, I guess. I mean, you know, but again, you know, they're doing it outside, but like, you know, shaking hands after the match and stuff like that, like stuff I would not do.
I can see that. Like, are they using like hand sanitizer or anything? Or are they just like, ah, fuck it.
I mean, maybe it's at some courses, the course I've played, the last weekend, there was none of that. The ball went in the cup, you know, all that stuff.
That's a really hard one for me. Like when people were playing with there's two schools of thought on this. Like when they were playing with like the pool noodle in the hole, like that seems really weird to me. But then they developed this thing where they like, there's a hook that you can put on the flag and you can just pull it out with your putter. And then people were like, well, I wouldn't want to ruin my putter. Like that also seems somewhat insane to say as well. Like what are we talking about here?
Yeah, that also seems insane. I mean, I just reached down in the hole and got my ball and like whatever again, you know, just sort of operating on the theory like I'm outside. I am just going to count on transmission rates being low and try not to be too neurotic about this.
What do you do with the bunkers? You just play it as it lies, move it around, don't rake it, that kind of thing?
Yeah, no rake. I think I only this course I played at does not have a ton. I think I hit it in the bunker once and I just pulled it out. I just pulled it out and hit it from the rough and I just didn't get in because I didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, like it's just like, I mean, if you're not, you know, if you're not out there like as like a 5 handicap, like trying to improve your scores and you're just trying to get out of the house, like, you know, don't be a hardo.
That's how I also feel about people who wear pants at the golf course.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be like 40 degrees for me to wear pants at the golf course.
Yeah, it needs to be cold to wear pants at the golf course. Like, if you're wearing pants at a golf course and it's a super hot day and you don't play on the PGA Tour, you're an asshole.
Yeah, you are an asshole. Like, there are many assholes. Like, you're going to find a lot of assholes at golf courses. It's really a place that draws them in.
Maybe, maybe not. Like, you get more of, like, your rich asshole at a golf course.
Yeah, that I mean, yeah, yeah, just like your fads.
But not all rich people are assholes and not all not True. Rich people aren't assholes. Like assholes are assholes across the board.
there are many assholes of many variety, many of all sizes, shapes and colors. That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, I maybe it's just because I think we're seeing a lot of this too. And I don't want to step on my show on Monday because we opened with the MLB labor talks and just like Blake Snell and Trevor Bauer and that kind of thing. And you know that we've had these discussions. I'm not particularly like pro union or anything like that, but this is a situation where I understand the value of a union for the players because the players are getting raked through the coals here with bad publicity. But what they're saying is absolutely true.
Yeah. No doubt about it. Like they are just getting taken advantage of. There's not really, I don't really think there's a way around that. Like the billionaires are trying to get them to play for discounted rates, and baseball players in general, they are, the way that the wage structure is set up, you're structured to be underpaid until you're 30.
And I don't want to get too deep into the weeds of it and step on Cuss, because I think he makes a good point with this, is it's just generally the optics of it. No one disagrees with what they're saying. And it's hard for someone to say, because I just kind of compared it to, if you were making $25 an hour to do a job, but because of the pandemic, sales were down, and they said, you know what, in order to keep your job, you can only make $15 an hour now. And you agreed to that because that only makes logical sense. The business isn't making a lot of money. You need to reduce your wages. The wages of the overall company are going down. That makes sense. It's like that, but then the owner comes in and says, you know what, I'm only going to pay you $5 an hour now. Eventually, you're just like, fuck this. Like, you know, we agreed to this. You can't keep changing the goalposts on our negotiated contract that comes down. We were willing to give it up and reduce our pay to a prorated rate for how many games. You can't expect us to take less than that. Like, someone eventually has to make a stand. And there's a disconnect between someone who makes $15 an hour and a guy who makes $33 million a year. But the principle is exactly the same.
Yeah, the principle is 100% the same. And yeah, and but people, you know, people don't see it that way because of the raw, you know, just the raw amount of dollars that are out there. They just view those things as different.
Yeah. And like, that's tough to, I understand that's very tough to do. Like, I'm far closer to the person who makes the $15 an hour than the guy who makes $4 million a year. Like, I get why I can't put myself into that situation. But, like, in a nutshell, economically, and as someone who works, like, I understand the point that the players are making.
Yeah, I mean, the players have the thing that's valuable, and they're saying, you know, if you want to make money off of us, you need to compensate us, you know, fairly, right? And I mean, and I guess fair is where all of that, you know, where the arguments come in. It's like, what would fair be?
Sure. And then you see the other people would be like, well, I would play baseball. Like, you're so greedy. I would play baseball for free. It's like, yeah, well,
I'd play it for free because I love the game.
Yeah. No one's asking you to play for free, pal. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that is why people get upset, is because they can only see things from their perspective.
And people making, there's a really interesting case that people make about, like, well, frontline workers don't make as much as, you know, MLB baseball players, and they're still out there working, they're putting their lives on the line, and they don't understand that they're making the opposite argument for the players, being like, yeah, we don't need to come back. Like, we're not essential workers.
Yeah, we're not essential workers, and we are, and people, those people are also kind of owning themselves in the sense of, like, you're right, healthcare workers should absolutely be making more money, which is, you know, interestingly, not really a perspective that I've seen thrown out there. You know, I've seen more of the, you know, hashtag thank you healthcare workers stuff than just pay these people more.
The Canadian government actually stepped in, I think 5 weeks ago it was, and all healthcare workers, frontline workers, got, like, because, you know, the governments are just cutting blank checks at this point, right? Like, every government in the world. That one of the things that they did was instituted, I think it was a 15% raise for all frontline healthcare workers, just from the government, like, thanks.
Well, the United States federal government did not do that for American healthcare workers.
Well, that's also a part of the sending everyone back. I think that's why some of the governors are doing it, because it's draining the budgets, the economy.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, if they're,
state governments are getting wrecked.
Yeah, like, if business is open, we don't need to pay unemployment.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like, part of the reopening thing is a hustle to not have to pay as much unemployment, because if your businesses are open and you say, I don't want to go because I don't want to get COVID,
that's on you.
That's on you. Yeah, you don't get unemployment.
Which sucks. I mean,
very
that's
sad.
Yeah, but I mean that's really the reason for a lot of this stuff. Which I mean, I get the quicker we can get this back going, and we establish some sort of new normal of how we're going to live, and that new normal is an incremental pace to get back to the way that it was before all this started, I'm completely for that. I just don't want to see the Mao giant leap forward and have it turn out as badly as that did.
Yeah, we don't want that. But, you know, I don't know. Like, at some point, it does just sort of become about risk tolerance, and some people will be more risk averse, and some people will be more risk tolerant, and, you know, the risk tolerant people will, you know, maybe get rewarded or maybe not, you know, who knows?
Well, it's funny to hear you say, like, you have a risk aversion to a lot of this stuff. Like, you'll be the last person to fly or go back to an amphitheater or a sporting event.
Because I'm a disgusting gambler.
Well, just because you seem to be entirely, like, inherently risky in everything else that you do in your life.
Yeah, there are some risks that I like taking that I'm more predisposed to take. But, like, you know, have you ever taken one of those, like, you know, personality tests of, like, you know, what matters to you? You know, like, I think it somehow ties it. I haven't taken one of these for years, but I will always remember that at some point for some eval thing, I had to take like a what matters to you test, and I scored like a 100, like 100% of like a need for me is like survival. Like I'm like terrified of dying, right? Or terrified of getting like really sick. And so that's like a huge driving force for me. And I, yeah, like that's just true. Like I don't want to get sick and die of COVID at all.
So the big thing with you is like in terms of like your risk tolerance for different things, anything that would affect your mortality is one thing, but like money is money. Money comes and goes. I can be as risky as I want with that.
Yeah. Like, or like, you know, there's not really that much of a difference between making, you know, X amount of dollars a year or, you know, two times that, like, cause it's not enough money to be rich or to really be poor. So like, I should take these financial risks because if I take X, Y, and Z amount of financial risk, maybe I can become like actually rich. So like, I'm fine, like risking, like, you know, what would to some people be like an irresponsible amount of money, because like the difference of things does not make as much of a difference to me. Whereas like, there's not a sliding scale of being dead.
No, there's not. But I'd actually be curious to know what you think that amount of money is, because I would wager that like doubling your money, for example, that if you made $30,000 a year and all of a sudden you made $60,000 a year, that would be different. That would be a huge shift in your life. Like that would be a more impactful thing on your life than someone who is making $500,000 a year, making $1 million a year. Like, I think like there yes. gets to be a cap. Like if you were making $60,000 a year and all of a sudden you were making $120,000 a year, that is an incremental jump as well. But if you went from,
it is, but what is what? So at that point, if you're making $60,000 a year and you don't live in, you know, a huge city or anything like that, you know, you live somewhere relatively affordable, I don't know how much different your life really becomes if you go to $120,000 a year.
Well, there's a safety net in your life now. Like if you make $60,000 and you live in, let's say, a median place, you can afford your house, you can afford your car, you can afford to put food on the table, but if anything shitty happens in your life, you don't necessarily
you're toasted.
You're toast. And like if you make the $30,000, like you're living paycheck to paycheck basically. So there is never room for savings. But even if you're saving at $60,000, obviously if you make double the money of the $30,000 person, your entertainment budget is a little bit bigger. You're probably not as frugal as you once were. So even the savings don't necessarily, like let's say you're someone who saved at $30,000. And you were able to save money, like you budgeted your life that way. No matter how much money you make, you're always going to be that frugal. Like if you make $100,000 a year, you're going to save tons of money because you've always been good at saving money. You've found a way to do that, to budget yourself, and you can probably hold yourself to those rules. Most people don't do that very well. Most people are very bad at saving. But if you went from $60,000 to $120,000, you would just have more wiggle room. Now, I think going from like $120,000 to $240,000, there's less of a difference there.
So it definitely, what you're saying is true about more wiggle room, but it doesn't change your, like, going from 60 to 120,000 doesn't change your day to day all that much. Like, it's still probably not enough for you to go out and, you know, go buy a house or go buy like some crazy nice car or get a pool installed. Like, it makes you more comfortable. It probably like reduces, you know, some of your anxiety and stuff. But and I mean, maybe this is wrong, and maybe other people live differently than me and have maybe I don't have enough needs, or maybe my needs are just different from other people. But I don't know if, you know, if my, you know, if I went to making $200,000 a year, I can't think of, you know, how different. I mean, I would gamble more, right? Like, I would gamble higher stakes and stuff, but I don't know how much my day to day would really change.
No, but you'd probably save a lot more money.
Probably would save a lot more money. Yeah, that's probably true.
Like, and that all ends up on, I mean, if you're a, you know, someone who inherits risk, and you, I mean, not necessarily like sports gambling or gambling in general, you would buy more Bitcoin. You would take more risk in the stock market, because if it went wrong, you're not out everything.
I mean, I still do make a lot of financial risks in terms of stock market and Bitcoin and everything, but you are right that I would take even more risks, that I would put even more of my net worth down on those things. That is true.
Yeah, but and you would also have the safety net that if everything went to zero, you'd still probably be fine.
I'd still be okay. Yeah. So, I see what you're saying.
But there gets to, like, there's a breaking point with that where obviously in terms of affording your lifestyle, being comfortable, having a safety net, buying, building a portfolio, anything like that, the more money you make, the better, when it comes down to all of it. But there are different gaps in, like, doubling the amount of money that you would have that are far more impactful on people's lives day to day and the stability of their lives at a certain point. Like, I would say $100,000 is probably the cap. Like, if you go from making $100,000 to $200,000, like, obviously you're making double what you made before, but you're already making a really good salary.
I think the most recent thing that I read about this, because I, like you, find this to be a pretty fascinating subject, is that there is not a marked difference in happiness for people after they cross $70,000 a year is the most recent thing I remember reading. Let me see if I can go find the source for that right now.
How do you gauge happiness? Because, like, on the happiness index in terms of, like, place to place, country to country, like, the United States is not super high.
Right.
Like, money isn't the only contributing factor to happiness. Like, I know a lot of rich people who are supremely unhappy. And I know a lot of, like, I wouldn't say poor people, but people not doing great and are completely happy. Like, I think that's your personality to begin with, your environmental factors of where you live, the society that you live in. And a lot of it is, like, chemical balance within you, too. The stuff you just simply cannot control. Unless you're, like, on drugs.
Yeah, well, you know, the cause of all suffering is desire. That is like universally true.
Explain that to me more. I'm trying to wrap my mind around that. Like, wanting?
Yeah, or just wanting or needing anything that you don't have. Like, that is what causes suffering. Like, if you think about the things that pain you, it's like, you know, I'm sad because this didn't happen, or, you know, and a lot of that also relates to our attachment to things, you know, our wanting for things to be different, like our inability to be serene and comforted by just living and existing is the cause of what ails us. This is not me being a philosopher. These are literally just the tenets of Buddhism.
I would throw back at that, just using me as a personal example. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, my life, that when I have a goal and I'm focused on accomplishing something or wanting more, that drives me, and I'm generally a happier person when that happens. I find myself to be the most unhappy when I'm just simply having nothing to do.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily desire in the context of the way we think about it as, like, Western people of, like, you know, wanting to get things done or whatever. It's more like attachment to just, like, things in the mortal world, like the things that bum us out, the things that cause us pain, are just very likely to be, like, physical, like, non-ethereal things that we want or need for whatever reason.
Like, material goods is basically what you're saying.
Or like like I really want to be loved, or I really want to feel the X, Y, or Z from this person. Like those are things that are very likely to cause us pain.
I can see that. That actually makes a lot of sense to me. But I do think a lot of it is just independent on the person too. Like everyone's wired so differently, and things can be off in you that you don't even know about, which are causing a lot of this.
Yeah. I mean, that's a much larger conversation about, you know, like biochemical depression and, you know, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar, you know, all of that. But like the general way, and again, people always get mad. Like if I get something wrong, like this is the way I understand things, which is just that the things that cause, and this is how I understand things for me, is like when I feel myself being upset, sad, whatever, it's because I want something, whether that be like, I want to not feel bored, I want to not feel hungry, I want to not feel sad. Like it's all wanting to feel something other than what I'm feeling in that moment for whatever reason.
Oh, well, I hope you're doing better with this.
Yeah. I mean, no, like I actually think that, quarantine has been helpful for me in terms of regulating my own behavior, because you are so often just left alone with your thoughts these days, right? Like you just are. I'm spending more time in solitude than ever before, really.
Yeah. So do you think that this has been a net positive for you, for self-reflection, that kind of thing? Or do you just think you're ready to have this all over?
No, because I can't go to the fucking gym.
Eventually, like you're going to be allowed to go to the gym. Eventually, like the Amazon back order of even just buying your own gym, like you can just set up something in your house and you'll be fine.
I have not been able to motivate myself for in-home workouts. I've done some stuff at home. I've been running. I've been out skateboarding a couple times. Like I've done more things, but like I just undoubtedly, like I was in such a good fitness health routine before this started, and my desire to go to the gym, have 2 hours to just go run and lift weights and get sweaty and get gross, and that whole routine, I can't get over missing it.
Yeah, I miss that too, and my fitness has suffered because of it. But I finally got my dumbbells the proper weights delivered to my house, but just like having the dumbbells around, I finally went out and I got myself a bench as well. Like just being able to continuously lift weight at home. Well, I'm gaining weight and I feel like a fat person now, although I'm clearly, I'm not, but like, I'm just not used to being this heavy. But I think a lot of it just has to do with like my dieting has been really bad, and not that like I'm not eating McDonald's and fast food 3 times a day. It's just, it's that extra meal. And like I have more time than ever at home, but I'm far less likely to cook than I used to be, which is really weird. Like there is something that goes along with it. It's all wrapped up in one. Like I've always found it really hard to eat clean and eat healthy if I'm not working out at the pace that I want to work out. That the general malaise of, yeah, I'm lifting weights, but I'm not running as much as I was. And instead of working out for an hour, I'm working out for half an hour. Like it's just a bunch of little things like that. But that has translated over into like a laziness in the rest of my life too.
No, I completely, yeah, I could not understand this anymore. Like if I'm like, well, if I'm not working out, you know, if I'm not running an hour a day and then getting in an hour of lifting weights, like what's even the point? Like I just want to sit on the couch and be a fat piece of shit.
Yeah. And it works doubly the opposite way. Cause when you're eating well and doing double the workout, it's like 4 times as good for you. And then you scale back the workout to half the workout that you were doing, or even less potentially. And you're eating poorly. Like my body's just, it's like, oh yeah, yeah. We're not healthy anymore. Like screw you basically.
Yeah, no, it's true. And like, it's just there's a whole motivation quandary that I'm not even sure how to solve, basically.
You have to either develop a new routine and stick to it. Like that's been my hardest part, because I started doing HIIT workouts outside when it was nice out, but it rained like 3 days in a row, so I didn't do it three days in a row, and then I haven't done it since. And like that's not like me.
Yeah, like it's every time I've gotten into a routine, you know, I do something 3 days in a row, then oh, I don't feel good the next day, or I got a call late one day, so I skip it, and then it's been a nightmare, and it's really probably exposed to me how non-mentally strong I am compared to where I would like to be.
Well, it's funny because like when I got my life kind of back on track to where I started out, like even in this industry to where I'm at now, like hard work ethic, everything like that kind of correlated when I first started working out seriously. Like I took the time to, like, I was fat and out of shape. So I was like, I gotta lose like 30 pounds right away. I was like 230 pounds at the time. I was like, I need to get below 200 and I need to get myself into good shape. You know, change your diet up, start working out, start running, like very incremental things. And then I got into pretty good shape. Because I had stopped playing sports by that time. I started playing sports again. But all of that stuff turned into one. Like, and then all of a sudden, I was a much harder worker than I was before. Like, I had the mental stability to focus on things and follow through on things. And I feel like I'm leaning back towards where I was before. Now, I have different priorities, obviously, at the same time. This is the last show that I'm filming before my wife and I introduce our second child into the world, hopefully. Obviously, I don't know that as of right now. We're scheduled for Sunday, but that could always, you know, turn out to be 3 days from now. They could push us back another week. Who knows, depending on what's going on. But that's where my primary focus is right now. It's not on working. It's not on any of that. It's, you know, making sure that the kids are okay. We don't have family that can come up and help us. So my wife and I, we have, like, she's going to have a newborn. She's going to have just went through labor. So it's going to be incumbent on me to make sure that our 16-month-old is fed, put to bed, watched at all times. If we had some more help, it would be easier to do the kind of other things. And I want to make sure that even though I'm taking care of him from 6 a.m. till 7 p.m. every single day, that I don't want to let my health get completely out of whack. Like, if I can just maintain where I'm at right now, like during the quarantine, I think that would be okay. I would like to improve it, but I just think that might be unrealistic. But I don't want it to slip either at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge challenge, I would imagine. You know, of I imagine literally like all parents have this quandary of like, well, shit, you know, like I'm stuck watching this kid. How am I, you know, how am I going to exercise? How am I not going to become, you know, fat over the course of quarantine? You know, who really knows?
I don't think it's so much. I don't think it's so much as a being like to the point I was trying to make. It's not so much of me becoming fat and unhealthy. It's just once that starts happening to me, my mental capacity to focus
just goes way down.
And I don't want that to happen. Like, if I'm like, there's nothing really more important than taking care of my son and taking care of my wife and a newborn, because like she's, you know, for at least a few weeks, like she's going to be laying in bed most of the day and taking care of the baby, that kind of thing. Like a newborn that's feeding off of her, she's going to be tired. Like, it's incumbent upon me to have energy, to have focus, that I worry that if I don't get in some sort of working out, that I have to build that in, just because that's how, like we talked about, people function in different ways. People's internal chemical balance is different. Like, I am pretty sure that all of these things that I normally do, eating well, working out, leads to me having more energy, having more focus, because I don't want that to slip when I have to take care of my family at this point in time. Because if we had help, that would be different. Like, if my parents were able to come up or her parents were able to come up, we could shuffle that off to them a little bit. But this is just a really bizarre situation because of the point in time that we live in.
Yeah, it's like it's your mental health is very tied to your physical health. Like, if you are working out, you're feeling good, your endorphins are going, your heart is healthy, right? Like, it is the positive effects to your body are like, your body and your mind are like almost unlimited if you are in like a good regular exercise routine. Like, when I am in a bad mental headspace, it's almost like certain to be not coinciding with working out. Like, the further I am from like a good workout routine, the closer I will be to just being in like a not great mental place.
Yeah, I feel like that's ubiquitous across the board for people, but I could be completely wrong about that. I know some people who work out and they feel like death for 5 days. They're usually people that don't work out. And the common mistake that I think that people make who don't work out, that try to work out, is they try to do way too much the first time.
Yeah, they go way too hard. Yeah.
And then they never go back. So like I know that there are programs out there for it, but when you see like fitness programs for people, it's usually for people that are wanting to be fit to begin with, which
fit.
Which, yeah. Which as a market, I understand, because people that are concerned about fitness want to get like, oh, how can I maintain? How can I get a six pack? How can I get large? Like those different types of things, because they're just more willing to buy that kind of thing. But I think that there is probably it's probably a softer market, and it's probably more exposed than I know about. But like intro to working out, you don't see a lot of that stuff.
I'm sure it's out there. I'm sure that it is not as profitable as, you know, selling a product to people that already want it. And I'm sure there are, you know, there are loads of barriers in the way from someone who's like I'm like right now I'm like out of shape, but I'm not like disgusting. But like if I was 50 pounds heavier, like, man, I don't know if I would, what steps it would take me to like get me to go back to the gym. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there are so many obstacles in the way.
I honestly think that changing your diet before doing any sort of exercise is the first thing that you need to do. That would be like if I was to write the book on this, like just learn how to eat better. And that's not to say like you can't eat all the stuff that you currently enjoy. Maybe your diet or your eating better, just eat 20% less than you currently do.
Eat a little less, maybe skip dessert. I mean, intermittent fasting, I think, would be a great direction for a lot of people to go in, right? Like, I think that would be good for a lot of people.
Well, yes and no. I think that would be effective, obviously, but the rigorous rules of intermittent fasting, I think, are really good for some people because they keep you in line, but those are probably also the people that don't have a problem forcing themselves to go work out either. Like, it's all part and parcel, kind of the same thing. Like, can you follow the rules? These are the rules. Like, I work out 11 a.m. every single day, so you work out at 11 a.m. every single day. I only eat – this is not me. This is just a straw man. I eat from 11. I have my first meal at 10 a.m. every day, and I have my last bite at 5 p.m. every day, and I don't eat outside that window. That's great, but it seems like the person who works out regularly every day is the person who would be more apt to eat that way too.
Well, all of this stuff that we're talking about is all mental discipline stuff. And you're not going to become the most mentally disciplined person. You know, you're not going to develop those skills overnight the same way you're not going to develop giant biceps overnight, right? And I would say that intermittent fasting, and this is, I'm sure it's different for everyone else. For me, intermittent fasting was a good way to start working out the muscle of being disciplined about what I was putting in my body.
So I've tried to do intermittent fasting during the isolation and the quarantine.
That's not going to work for me.
It didn't work for me at all. And like, but again, that went back to when I was working out a bunch, I found it really easy. And I needed more. Yeah. I needed more food when I was working out more, but now I'm doing less and eating more food.
Right. Yeah. I mean, quarantine has just thrown so many things in a loop for so many people, I'm sure. And like you talked about, I mean, I tried to do the intermittent fasting thing during this, and it was not a successful experience for yours truly.
Yeah, that's going to be a bummer. Well, I don't have a ton of stuff outside of like Trump super duper missile to talk about, which I just thought was like the funniest thing I've seen in some time.
I just am to the point with him where I just am like, I can't even really talk about him. Cause like, what is there to say? Like he's not a good person. He's not handling the government very well. And it's just, he just puts me on tilt to think about, and talking about the election is just as tilting because all the outcomes there are bad basically. And so it's just, we're just really sweating out the next 4 years and hoping that, the pandemic, someone put this to me the other day. I think it was actually on this show yesterday with Rotopat, but they said, what if 2020 is actually the good year? Like, we think 2020 is terrible, and we're like, oh my God, everything's terrible. Everyone's dying everywhere. But what if 2020 is the good year, Pat?
You would like to believe that that's not the case.
I go back and forth between being overly pessimistic and thinking 2 million people are going to die in America from the coronavirus to like, it's going to be fine. We're resilient people. We have a lot of smart scientists, a lot of great doctors. It's going to be fine. Like this whole thing has really, put my optimism meter to the test.
Well, I don't listen to Bill Simmons as much as like I used to like 5 years ago, but I will always tune in anytime Klosterman is on with him. I think Chuck Klosterman is my favorite media personality by far. Like, it's not even close. I just I enjoy listening to him talk. Like, I listen to this podcast with him and Chris Ryan that's only on Spotify called Music Talks? Music Lives?
Music Exists.
Music Exists, yeah. See, I don't even know what the title is. But I listen to all of them. I don't even really care about music. I just enjoy the conversations that he tends to have. And he pointed this out when he was on the Simmons podcast the other day. I was just like, hey, Klosterman. I got, like, jazzed up when I see that he's on. That our collective memory of the quarantine is likely going to be positive because that's just how we remember things.
Yeah, we think about how things went well.
Yeah, not even things how it went well, but like I think it was his point, like 20 years from now when people's kids are going off to college, you'll be like, wow, I remember that time during the quarantine where I spent every day with my kids. Like, that was great.
That's so fun. I mean, it's probably true. I don't know if I like Klosterman as much as you do, but that is like a very interesting point that like, yeah, like I will probably think about the quarantine and I won't think about like how triggered I got every day by our idiot president. I will probably think about like, oh wow, you know, that was really nice to be home with my girlfriend every day. And I spent so much time with my dogs and we trained them a bunch and like, that was great. Like you're right. I probably will not think of it as like this terrible experience, you know, cause I didn't lose my job. No one I know has died of the coronavirus yet. So like, I think all of that's very possible.
Yeah. And it's going to be dependent on what happened to you during this time. But I mean, this isn't going to be the case for everyone, but the vast majority of people haven't lost their job or know people that have died.
Yeah, I think I read that like 1 in 4 people know someone who has gotten the coronavirus. I don't know about who has died of it.
And
but
what,
yeah,
and,
either way, it wouldn't be the majority.
And what's unemployment up to now, percentage wise? Has it cracked 20?
Very high.
Has it cracked 20?
Well, unemployment rate as a number is fraught, but let's Google it. What do we think it is? I think it's probably 25%.
I'll say 20, but there's a lot of stuff baked into that too. Like not a lot of the people, I don't actually know what the actual breakdown is, but I know a lot of people who have been laid off for the moment, but they're going to get their jobs back once everything
furloughs.
Yeah. Like that's a lot of people.
Yeah. So right now, it looks like, well, okay, never mind. It looks like about 15% on tradingeconomics.com. I've never heard of this website before. It might not be legit, but I know that we have seen the largest week over week increases in unemployment claims ever over the last couple weeks. So for whatever that means.
I am very excited just because I'm a fan of just weird theater and just like hypocrisy as humor that when Trump starts taking credit
when the unemployment goes down.
Yeah.
We've seen the biggest. Yeah. I mean, this is just this. That's
Davis.
Davis,
people say they have never seen anything. Just ask them. It's terrific. The job rate up 10% in 1 week.
It's amazing. It's amazing how predictable this stuff is. But yeah, obviously, when people start going back to work, he'll be like, "This never happened under Obama. We never saw this many people get jobs. It's going to be incredible stuff.
That's going to happen. Like, just write that in."
Yeah, I also think if we're playing Trump bingo, him inventing something about Obama in the middle of this should have been on the Trump bingo card, right?
Well, I don't
Obamagate.
Like, well, I got cussed to describe because Cuss is pretty plugged in with this kind of not like Obamagate, but just actually knows the news of a lot of this stuff. Like what? Because I'm still confused what Obamagate is, and he kind of explained it to me.
No one knows.
Well, he explained. I was like, because I asked him, I was like, do you know what Obamagate is? And he explained it to me. I was like, oh, that makes sense. And he's like, it's ridiculous to bring it up at this point in time. He's like, it's just a deflection thing. He's like, yes, what they did was wrong, but it's nothing outside of the parameters that like it's probably more aggressive than what presidents would have previously done or their administrations anyway, but like it's not shit like this happens with every president, so it's not that big of a deal. And it was almost my counter to be like, because Trump was talking about like bringing Obama in front of like a grand jury and for Senate hearings. Like, if he does that, then Trump has to do all this stuff when he's out of office too. I don't think he wants to set that precedent.
Well, Trump's never going to leave office because he's just going to cancel the elections.
Yeah. You think all the freedom people are going to be super pumped about that?
Yeah, because it's their dude.
I don't know.
I think the way that that libertarians have sold out for Donald Trump has been sort of interesting to me.
I really think that your take on who's a libertarian and who's not is just vastly
strange. Well, I can only know from online, you know.
Yeah, most of those people aren't fucking libertarians. They're just crazy people.
That could be true.
People you converse with online, by and large, are insane people. Especially people that want to talk about this sort of stuff. Like,
that's true.
They can say that they're a libertarian. That's great. They can also say that they're not racist. They're probably racist.
That's true.
Put it this way. I don't want to say that everyone online is racist who claims that they're not racist. But if someone told you online that they were not racist, you probably wouldn't believe.
I'd be like, oh, yeah, you're racist for sure.
Yeah, but if they say that they're libertarian, you just believe that they're libertarian?
Well,
most people who claim to be libertarians don't even know the actual, like, what libertarianism is.
Well, I don't think that doesn't stop them from being a libertarian, though.
I think that it probably does.
No, because it's a political ideology. And if you say, like, if I say, like, I'm a liberal, that means that I'm a liberal, right?
Yeah, but that a liberal, by and large, has a lot of
meanings.
It's a wide spectrum of what that could mean. Like, I would say that I'm a fairly liberal person, but me being a liberal and you being a liberal has two severely different connotations.
Yeah, and especially now in the United States with we just will see all sorts of conservative policies come from the Democrats. And then, you know, this is actually true that Mitt Romney was the first person to suggest universal basic income as a solution to this crisis. So yeah, it's these definitions get mixed up all the time. But I guess
it's weird because Mitt Romney doesn't really fit on the political spectrum. He's in his, and this is where like the political spectrum nowadays between like liberal and conservative doesn't really make a lot of sense, because you need to put in there are obviously different poles of that, but there's a polarization amongst people who are like on either side that needs to be factored in. And Mitt Romney just has rich guy politics, like. Decent human being, rich guy politics. Like, he's going to be out of touch on things because he's so rich that just some of this stuff doesn't occur to rich people. But at the same time, like, for being a super duper rich person, I mean, Mitt Romney took over the Olympics when they were going to go under and made them work. Like, you talk about universal basic income, like, is an idea that he may have proposed. Like, at least he's thinking about that stuff, how his money can go to help people.
Yeah, his whole, like, I mean, people from his party are mad at him. And the reason why things are so interesting in the States is that there really is not a left party anymore. There's just the right and the center now. And so that has really aided into the polarization, because there are so many people now that feel disenfranchised, which has just made the polarization stuff even worse.
Yeah, a far left party would actually go a long way in curbing some of the right wing stuff, because like obviously like a super duper right wing party would never work, because you need those people in the center to vote Republican in order for it to actually work. So part of the problem has become that the centrist Democrats have been really attached to like the really progressive Democrats, that if you had a super left wing party, a lot of the centrist people who vote Republican would just almost automatically
become Democrats. Yeah, and I mean this is a huge problem with the Electoral College and two-party system, and you know, we're not saying anything that people don't already know about the way American politics works.
No, but I mean, as someone who comes from a parliamentary system, like, you see a lot of the same sort of problems. Like a fractured left in Canada drove the one conservative party it's kind of the inverse of what happened in the States. Like, the conservatives got the most votes in the Canadian election, but they came a huge second to the Liberal Party because the Liberal Party won more seats, but they also split up the vote with like four leftist parties.
Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, I would imagine in the States we'd have the the super far right, which is like the Trump people, and then we'd have the people who vote Republican despite not, you know, because of money, right? Because of taxes and stuff like that. And then we'd have the centrist Democrats that don't like that don't want to be taxed a ton and still think that we should have loads of rich people. Yeah, but still
Democrats,
think we should have
Democrats who hate AOC.
Yes, and then we'd have the Young People Party, which would be
the worst because no one would vote in it.
Tough scene. It's true. I mean, I've never missed an election day, but I am positive that, I mean, the numbers just show that many people my age never vote.
Yeah, look at Bernie. Bernie was going to do great, wasn't he? With all those young people.
Ugh, very, very tough scenes for Mr. Bernard.
So you would get into a situation where it would make the centrist party too, because if you had a super right party and a super left party, the Democrats and Republicans would merge into one as the centrist party, and the centrist party would win like 80% of the vote.
Would crush, yeah. And I mean, I guess the interesting thing is most, most political people do just sort of agree that there's not really that big of a difference between the political parties in the states, that like by and large, their policy, like it's really just on the fringes where they even disagree about anything.
Yeah. And those become the polarized fringes. And those are the people that you hear about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I mean the politicians, not, I'm sure, you know, the average right person, left person, they don't agree on anything, but the way that the parties work, they mostly serve the same interests.
Yeah, because, I mean, think about the people that become politicians. Like, I remember talking to, I was the best man at his wedding, he stood in my wedding, his mom is a lawyer, she was going to become a judge, they keep trying to get her to run for political office, she doesn't want to, she's like, I like being my lawyer, I like owning my own family law firm, that's what she does, that's what she's done for like 35 years. But when she was in law school, she was in law school with like four people, like in her class, who ended up becoming major Canadian politicians. And some of them were super left, some of them were super right. She's like, they're all fucking the same person. Like, they went to law school so they could become politicians.
They just want power.
They want power. Like,
yeah.
Not every politician is like that, but, like, that's why 85% of them, like, get into it at an early age. Like, they take the steps. Like, when you see the senior in high school who's doing all these weird, like, charity stuff, like, that's not what most 18-year-olds or 17-year-olds really want to be doing, but they're padding their resume to get into the good college. The good college will lead to the good law school. The good law school will lead to you can work in this person's office.
They're dweebs.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest thing about Trump that kind of separated him. And Bernie's kind of the same way, that although Bernie has money now, he wasn't like, and he is a career politician. That didn't seem to be his background. He seemed like more like he was like someone who was a professor who somehow got into politics. And that's why Trump is so popular in a way, is that, well, he has the background of a lot of these guys. It's not the calculated background that they all went about to become a politician.
Yeah. And I mean, Trump's message also,
Trump doesn't have a message. It's just like, well, I'm saying stuff. Listen to it.
Well, what people, my opinion on why people like Trump, on why he was able to win so many votes when people didn't think he would, is that people sort of think of politics in a very simple-minded way, which is like, I just want one guy to fix everything. And Trump was like, I'm the guy. I'll fix everything. Yeah. I'll fix it all. Yeah. So that, to me, is sort of Trump's largest selling point to his base.
Well, that and everyone who was a centrist but potentially right-leaning person knew that taxes presumably wouldn't be going up under Trump.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, that was a lock for them. And they were like, well, that's my one issue. I'll vote for Trump.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I'm sure that is a primary voting issue for many people.
Yeah. And even, I mean, that's one thing that Biden's been pretty firm about over the primary, is that, I mean, the fact that he doesn't know where he is seems to be a problem. But
like, what is this guy doing? Like, he's just hiding in his basement.
If that's the move is for him never to talk and just don't even debate Trump and just have your name on the ballot in November and you probably win. The more he talks, the worse it gets for him.
Yeah, guy doesn't have, Biden. It's the worst.
Should just hide out. Hide out. Don't be stay out of the public eye. Yeah, don't.
Every time he opens his mouth, he says something stupid, basically.
Well, this is why I brought up DeCust, was imagine Bloomberg had won. Bloomberg, if it was Bloomberg right now versus Trump, Bloomberg would be polling at like 90%.
Yeah, he'd just be crushing.
Yeah. And that was always that was the case for Bloomberg anyway. It was just he was a disaster when he was running. But 1v1 versus Trump, like he would just be annihilating him right now.
Yeah, I mean, he would be, you know, much better at technology. He would just be he'd be figuring it all out.
Yeah, he also knows where he is. That helps.
Yeah, I've heard like knowing your own name, knowing what year it is, all of that, I think is generally helpful as a politician. I can't confirm it though.
I'm a big fan of these Joe Biden memes though. They're pretty funny.
Which ones?
Just like knock knock. Trump saying who's there, and then Biden saying who's there.
Who's there? That's I mean that is funny.
So I'm getting
I don't know.
As a non-American, I'm getting humor out of it at least.
Yeah, I'm sure it's funny as our politician becomes like I mean both of these guys are in the at risk COVID.
How did Trump not get this?
Trump's had COVID. He had to have had it.
And he has Trump genes. Beat the hell out of it.
Well, yeah, it doesn't kill everyone, right? No, not everyone gets the worst of it. So, yeah, like. Good for him.
So maybe the plan with Biden is that he's pretending to be senile. So when all this is over and he's like out there, that he like seems super sharp.
Gotta think. I don't view that as like a super sharp political strategy.
Yeah. Well, it could be working at this. Like if you set expectations so low for yourself and then you only need to beat them for 6 weeks or something at the end of the election, it makes you look really good.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're working on some special brain stuff to get him all sorted out soon.
Fuck, man, if he's not pumping himself full of like HGH right now, like he's doing something wrong.
Yeah, he needs to be on every kind of
stem cells, HGH, yeah. All of it.
Every Alzheimer's treatment that there is, like they got to be filling him full of experimental stuff.
You see, I don't like that part. I think that. I don't like when people say that. Like, you can say Joe's losing his mind, that kind of thing. But to say that, like, he has Alzheimer's or, like, a real disease, I think is kind of shitty to people who know people or
actually have it.
Like, yeah. Like, that's shitty to say.
He's just an old guy. Yeah, he's just senile.
Yeah, he's just, like, my grandfather's 75. Like, he's all over the map.
Yeah, like, that's like, Joe Biden is just, like, your grandpa who can only have like one beer at dinner. Cause if he has more than that, then he just like doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah. And amp that up by 1,000,000%. Cause the dude's under like the biggest pressure.
The most stress.
The most stress. There's a tremendous amount of stress, David.
A tremendous amount of stress.
But I have the best people, terrific people over here. They're helping me through it. Helping you. You listen to them. And then they start to talk.
No one's ever had better people.
When you have the best people, how could you have anyone better?
You couldn't.
All right, let's leave it at that. My wife is texting me, being like, where the fuck are you?
There we go. Everyone, that's the show.
That'll do it on the wrapping up the Corona cast.
Yeah, let us pray. Let us pray that this is the last one and we forget that all this ever happened.
Well, maybe in 2 weeks' time or something like that, I will have some time. I brought my audio equipment all home with me, and maybe you can record it on my behalf, send it, almost do the inverse of what we do right now, and send it to me, and maybe we can catch up in like 2-3 weeks' time.
Yeah, you'll probably be desperate for an adult conversation at that point, so I will be around.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for a millionaire pricing to drop for the Colonial. I'm all excited about that. That gives me something like.
And then you're ready to grind.
I actually said that I've already told my wife that I've marked out the days of when I'm coming back in to do my golf shows.
There you go. I mean, you gotta know what's really important in these uncertain times.
Well, as I told her, I was like, look, I took one day off after the last baby. And came back and kept recording shows. That was actually Tiger coming back for the Farmers. So, you know, wouldn't want to miss out on a Tiger week. I was like, look, I'm probably going to take like 3 weeks off full time. Like, I'll still be able to do what I can do from home. I can still do writing, that kind of thing. But in terms of like video stuff, I have all that done. But this is one thing that's going to be very important for me. just in general, like to get back and do the golf shows. Golf is never going to be randomly bigger than it is for Colonial. Mm-hmm. That it would be bad for my career if I didn't come back and do it.
Yeah, you gotta grind those clicks. No doubt about it.
Yeah, like there's going to be the opportunity for me to cast such a wide net with the return of golf in this moment is just really big for, I think, anyone who works in the golf space.
Yeah, it's massive. Like anyone, imagine not having 19 shows for the Colonial. Could never be Pat Mayo.
This is true. Treat it like it's the Masters. But I just look at the numbers that Paul and Cody, the increase in followers, the increase in downloads, the increase in views that they've done just because they're UFC show. Like, I would imagine that golf is going to be bigger than that.
Yeah, that is not a market that has reached its saturation with sports as currently constituted at all.
And I have a leg up on a lot of people who cover golf, especially in our either DraftKings or gambling industry, is that I'm SEO viable in this space.
Yep, you've already gained the system. So
yeah, I
I
will attract a lot of the people Googling golf picks. Like I will inherently just come up very high in those searches. So it means more to me than even a lot of people who might not be as like have as large of an audience as I do, that I think I'm in a good spot for this one. So I'm going to use my powers to have as many people from different places on as possible, because Davis, I like to spread around the wealth with inside the community.
You're a good man, Mr. Mayo. There's no doubt about it.
Well, the big thing is I need to push people to the people who actually know stuff, so I don't seem like a moron.
Or maybe you just have your best week of picks ever as a Colonial. How about that?
If somehow I have my best, not even to say that I win the Millionaire Maker or anything like that, but if some rando tuned into the Pat Mayo Experience and won the Millionaire Maker because of my picks, or I picked even just picking the winner that week on a bet would go a long way. I would say it would be the second most important pick that I've ever gotten right after Danny Willett.
Other than Mr. Trillett himself.
Yeah. Well, you hold up well, all right, man?
All right, man. You too. Good luck. I hope everything goes smooth with you and the kids. Tell the wife good luck.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and you stay safe. Tell the girlfriend I say hi. Tell the dogs, give them a pat on the head for me, and I'm out of here.
All right, man. Good luck. Enjoy your time off. Cleanse your brain a little bit.
I'll try to. Maybe I'll try to read. I'll learn how to read over this.
It seems like a lot to learn how to read and have a kid in the same time.
We'll see. Maybe I can bang it in. That's where I'll focus my mental energy to get myself back on track. Learn how to read. Step one.
That'll be, I'm interested to see the results of that experiment.
All right, man. See ya.